to Inside Higher Ed's podcast interview with Michael Barabay, author of the new book, What's Liberal About the Liberal Arts? Classroom Politics and Bias in Higher Education, published by W.W. Norton. Professor Barabay is paterno family chair in literature at Pennsylvania State University and a prolific cultural critic whose work has appeared in scholarly journals and popular magazines, as well as online at his blog, michaelbarabay.com. In addition to What's Liberal About the Liberal Arts?, he has just published a collection called Rhetorical Occasions, Essays on Humans and the Humanities, with the University of North Carolina Press. He is also an amateur hockey player, and the music for today's podcast is a blast from his past as drummer for the band Baby Opaque, which Barabay describes as post-hardcore thrash glam rock. The band left its mark in college radio history with its 1985 recording of Long Black Veil, featuring vocals by Ian McKay, better known from his work with Fugazi. Inside Higher Ed's intellectual affairs columnist, Scott McLemy, interviewed Professor Barabay about his work by phone. His work on the humanities and the culture wars, that is.
Welcome to Inside Higher Ed's podcast, Professor Barabay.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start with the title of one of your new books, What's Liberal About the Liberal Arts? It's tempting to ask you to answer that in 3 minutes instead of 300 words, but I'm also struck by how it seems as if you're marching under the banner of the single most friendless category in American political discourse now. And so I guess another question is, are you just like looking for a fight?
I've gotten a question from a friend who asked whether I was trying to avoid a fight, because that, as far as he was concerned, I'm, despite my deviationism, still a little bit left of most liberals, and he thought maybe I was seeking shelter under a more familiar umbrella term rather than, say, you know, what's progressive about the progressive arts. And I just thought what's progressive about the progressive arts had a just didn't flow.
Right, right.
Like George Lakoff meets, you know, Madame Blavatsky or something. And liberal arts, not only as a term in common currency, but I think there's something procedurally liberal about universities that will enable me to answer your question, I hope, in 3 minutes or less. Because at the end of the book, well, actually also in the end of the first chapter, I distinguish between substantive liberalism and procedural liberalism. And I say, you know, substantive liberalism is all the stuff that the right loves to hate, ranging back, you know, through the Progressive Era and then the New Deal, the Great Society, and actual liberal programs that, as I think Richard Rorty put it, liberals in the left tend to see the state as the apparatus by which the weak can be defended from the strong, and by which the inevitable distortions and excesses of the free market can be corrected by state actions. So that's substantive liberalism. And whether it plays out in, you know, gay marriage or the minimum wage or abortion, that's all the stuff that's associated with, you know, these campus radicals and their strange beliefs. But underlying this is, I think, a more sinuous or more elusive point about procedural liberalism that I think, or I fear, sometimes will resonate only with certain political theorists. And that has to do with the liberal idea that not every faction, and not every aspect of a society should be controlled by the same faction. That there should be room for minority reports and dissent to be, you know, incorporated into the body politic. And if you think of liberalism that way, as involving a kind of critical pluralism or plural public spheres, then you'll see, or I think you'll, I hope you'll agree, that there's something inevitably liberal about any institution that has that kind of independence from the state, you know, sort of in the civil society tradition. So insofar as universities don't answer directly to the state, insofar as they still don't, at least in this state, they fall under the heading of, you know, they have a degree of intellectual independence that is liberal with a small l. And I think that's part of what drives a sort of, not, I wouldn't call it conservative, I would call it a radical critique of universities. I mean, there's an aspect of what Horowitz and his folk are doing that is not conservative, that is in fact radical. As a member of the, they are members of the radical right, in the sense they really do think, on some level, that every institution that has these ties to the state, whether by funding or by virtue of being located in the state, should be answerable to the state for the actual content of the knowledge that they produce. And that, I think, is a notion that even most conservatives, certainly almost all thoughtful conservatives, will find repellent, because it is, like I say, a classically liberal ideal to have intellectual independence preserved for intellectuals, regardless of whether they are paid by the state or whether they're private universities or partly funded by the state.
Well, now, your distinction there between the radical right and conservatism proper is interesting, because I get the feeling in both of your books, but maybe particularly and maybe most paradoxically in the What's Liberal About the Liberal Arts book, I get the feeling that you have maybe not a nostalgia for a certain kind of conservative cultural commentary or presence, not just in the culture at large, but even in the academy. But certainly at least a recognition that has its place and is important and in some way is being obliterated by the likes of certain people undertaking campaigns of ideological correction.
I think that's exactly right. I mean it sincerely in What's Liberal About the Liberal Arts when I say that my field wouldn't be hurt, and in fact would be helped in many ways if we had more conservative job applicants and more conservative professors. I mean, it's actually part of my shtick that having some fields almost entirely dominated by liberals and the left is good neither for those academic fields nor for liberals and the left. I think there's a certain extent to which it makes both the liberals who are professors lazy, intellectually lazy, and it gives students, I quote the journalist, liberal journalist Ezra Klein on this, gives liberal students the entirely false impression that their ideas actually ring in the culture of the time, and that does them no good service either. And the more I thought about this line of argument, the more I realized that I think I describe cultural conservatives in the arts as being, you know, clustered around a handful of magazines like the Hudson Review and the New Criterion. And I know, for one, I enjoy reading a guy like Terry Teachout most of the time, because regardless of what his politics may be about abortion or the minimum wage or a war in Iraq, whatever, this guy's a cultural conservative who takes culture very seriously. And I think these people, the phrase I use in the book is, you know, I'm not sure if they're vanishing from the earth. There was a kind of conservative. There was a kind of conservative who's taking culture seriously degenerated into, you know, just mere veneration and quoting of the great books. But there was also a sort of counter movement both to that and to, you know, liberal and leftist reading of great books. One of the very strange things about the Horowitz campaign is that and I think that's not only about Horowitz, but about the Stanley Rothman and Lichter studies of, you know, liberal bias in the academy, is that because they don't do any work at all on the supply side, they really don't have any numbers, you know, any studies whatsoever on how many conservative job applicants there are. They're allowed to pretend, first of all, that there are tons of, you know, conservative applicants in all fields, and they're just being choked off by the liberal sluice gates of the interviews and the tenure process. But it also allows these folks to pretend that, you know, conservatives are sincerely interested in large numbers in the arts and humanities. And I still don't see much evidence that that's true. I think one of the things that's happened, as, you know, one wing of the Republican Party has, you know, gone from Eisenhower Republicans to fairly radical, you know, Tom DeLay kind of Republicans, is that they've lost in that coalition the sort of, you know, the Alan Bloom wing that was once, you know, fairly important to them. And, you know, it's going to sound weird to have, you know, Alan Bloom nostalgia, but there was a time when you could get into, you know, serious argument about culture and society, to use those terms, with people who call themselves conservatives and Republicans. It's increasingly rare. And I think it is tied to, but not the same as, the phenomenon, and I haven't seen too many people remark on this phenomenon, in which you find science faculties dominated by Democrats. Now, why is that? It can't be because search committees are actually looking for Democratic astrophysics and progressive biochemistry. it has to be because one wing of conservatism doesn't like science much. And I think Chris Mooney's book, Republican War on Science, you know, covers this terrain much better than I can. And I think you're seeing a sort of parallel phenomenon, a sort of, you know, broad anti-intellectualism among, you know, conservatives today that is really regrettable. When I say I'd like to see more conservative applicants, I'd like, you know, I think the words of Ross do that. But I quote, wrote an article in the New Republic last year that said it's not just the number of faculty, conservative faculty, that we should be worried about. It's the quality of conservative ideas that are competing in the academic marketplace of ideas that we should be concerned about. I think he's right about that. And as I say, I think my field would be healthier if there were, you know, more Mark Bauer lines out there.
Well, now, this one's for all the administrators out there, and I'll try to channel them, and if it comes out sounding like a caricature, well, that's just the way the bottom line sounds from a certain distance. So here it goes. What good are the humanities anyway, and why should we pay a living wage to anybody to teach them, let alone do research on them, whatever research means, and when it sure as hell looks like we don't have to unless a professor is a star, whatever that means?
Wow. Okay. I think I'm going to have to do at least a three-part answer, the first of which is the easy one. The reason you pay a living wage to anyone is that it's the right thing to do. It has enabled them to live. That's not to say that a lot of people teaching the humanities make a living wage, as I think I point out in the book. I think now we're talking about either two-thirds or three-quarters of the professoriate is teaching without tenure, and a good number of those are teaching part-time at barely living wages. So you know, the whole question about what academic freedom means for them is a side question that I couldn't do much more than gesture at a couple times in the book. The second thing, about what the humanities, how to justify the humanities in terms of the bottom line. I guess it depends on how far down the page your bottom line is, because if you're asking for, you know, just a fairly quick and dirty bottom line, I don't think the humanities or the arts are ever going to come out very well on that. There's just no evidence that we produce anything patentable. There's no direct evidence that we enhance either, you know, the earnings in a state or the earnings of individual graduates or the overall GDP. I could point in an indirect way to those studies that started coming out in the late 90s that show that actually what businesses want is not, you know, people who are narrowly trained in one field or another, but people with a broad and deep education who are capable of thinking on their feet and who are capable of multitasking and being self-directing and what have you. The reason it's an indirect argument is that I really can't prove that a close reading of The Odyssey, or for that matter, Beloved, will produce that. But I can say that people trained in liberal arts, and this is where I really don't have any quarrel, and I never had any quarrel with curricular conservatives. My argument about Western Civ and the great books tradition is that this is a record of how humans have thought deeply and well about such subjects as the good life and how to lead it, and that the more you understand about that tradition, the wider repertoire you have for productive thought about it. So I could point to those studies and say, look, what businesses really want is well-rounded people who know how to think in situations that may be unprecedented. Or they may be, as Martha Nussbaum argues, in Cultivating Humanity, they may be the best kind of people to send out to the new Beijing office because they have some idea of how to think about history and cultural difference. So there's that. There's also the fact that, if I wanted to make the Craven argument, I gesture at this in rhetorical occasions, is that sometimes I've come across administrators who have no idea what is done in the liberal arts or the arts and humanities, but they know that they have to have something in those product areas because the U.S. News rankings require it. And so if Berkeley and Yale have this Department of Fire-Eating Juggling, then we gotta have a Department of Fire-Eating Juggling as well. And that goes to the star question you ask. So that those administrators will tend to think, well, what you need in the humanities are just some names to drive up the rankings. We don't even care whether those names, you know, are actually on campus or whether they're flying around to other campuses, just as long as they shore up the rankings. And if that's the question, then I'm not so sure that stars are your best assets in a traditional humanities education. Anyway, I would say that everyone teaching in the liberal arts performs the function of deepening and broadening students' knowledge of what humans have thought and felt about the world. Now, let's move the bottom line way down the page and say, well, what does that mean eventually? Well, I think the argument to be made is that structurally, it is true that universities enhance their graduates' lifelong earnings. And it is true that universities also are enormous economic engines in their states, and that they produce all kinds of widgets that more than make back the initial investment put in by taxpayers and by other funders of the enterprise. All I'm going to say about that is, and what I do argue in liberal arts, is that we do so much basic R&D for American industry, and we are, you know, we're losing our lead internationally, but we still are the envy of the world in the higher education business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it really does not hurt at all to have fire-eating jugglers on staff. And it's not just the arts and humanities we should be talking about. A great deal of what goes on in the mathematics department does not turn up algorithms for Google or new things for the space program that will bring Tang to your breakfast table. There's a great deal of speculative thought elsewhere in the arts and humanities that should be funded as well, simply because, regardless of whether it contributes to the bottom line, it contributes to the intellectual enterprise. And if you, like I say, if you move the bottom line further down the page, then you say, well, look, if it's the bottom line you're concerned about, then we should all be University of Phoenix. We should all be for-profit universities. That end of question. But if you're concerned about the health of civil society, and if you're concerned about, you know, the quality of thought that graduates are capable of and can bring to civil society, then broader is better, deeper is better, and the bottom line will take care of itself eventually in terms of really a long-term investment that you see over 30, 40, 50 years rather than in the next quarter.
Mm-hmm.
As for why it's important to fund research in the humanities, again, you know, to some people, when you use the word research, they think of it as, you know, basic research and development. They think of it as R&D, and they don't see what the point is if there's no payoff. I think the phrase that I call to mind in rhetorical occasions when I am writing about how this played out at Illinois was that it was expected that research would have deliverables. And I couldn't imagine, this was in 99, I couldn't imagine that someone doing some research on the history of the Balkans,
mm-hmm.
trying to understand the current conflict there and the Kosovo crisis. I couldn't understand how someone could come up with a deliverable. I could understand someone coming up with an interpretation or an analysis, but really nothing that was going to enhance anybody's portfolio in that way, certainly nothing that would involve technology transfer. So my argument there is simply that the cultural heritage is extraordinarily complex and needs to be reinterpreted anew by each generation, simply because some of these questions are not settled, either about what constitutes the good life or just war, for that matter. This has been one hot topic. At the moment you're interviewing me, our country is actually debating whether torture should be part of the national profile. You would have thought that one was settled. Who knows? You know, that maybe slavery will be reopened in the next decade. But these questions that ranging from what constitutes, you know, the good person to what constitutes the good society, these questions are almost, I would say, constitutively unsettled. And whether you want to call the inquiry into them research or just plain interpretation, as I do, I think they're worth doing by everyone who can do them.
Well, now, in reading either book, I had occasional moments of deja vu with what's liberal. There's a portion about Thomas Kuhn, a long footnote on Kuhn, where I thought, well, that's familiar. I know that from somewhere. And then in rhetorical occasions, I guess makes it a little more explicit because you have an entire section of that book which reprints things that have appeared originally at your blog. And so there's a way in which, on the one hand, this is a pair of books which reflect changes in how someone can go about writing a book now, trying it out for an audience. At the same time, it's appearing at a time when discussions of whether blogging is acceptable, whether it will be creditable, what part of your CV you would put it on, whether you should, whether you should hide your identity. All of these things are kind of out there, and I'm wondering how much any of those, that latter sort of question, was in your mind in making an intervention, I suppose, in deciding to reprint blog entries in a university press book.
I think that's a great question. And I have to answer it two different ways. First, facetiously, by saying that at some point in my blog career, I began to wish that I were anonymous. I thought maybe actually I should do it the other way around. I should blog under my own name and have an anonymous CV and see how that works. The conflict that I felt in writing What's Liberal About the Liberal Arts was this. On the one hand, I put up that long Kuhn footnote, partly as a teaser, partly to let people know, if they were following the blog, that the book was not going to be just a series of retorts to Horowitz. It wasn't going to be, no, we're not that liberal, or, yeah, we're liberal and go stick it, or what have you. There was going to be a series of arguments as well, touching on the question of postmodernism and incommensurability. And actually, for my money, and I should know, I'm the author, that whole discussion in Chapter 6 of What's Liberal about incommensurability is, for me, the argument that eventually drives the rest of the book. If you can't get your mind around incommensurability and fundamental disagreement, then you're going to miss a great deal of what makes liberalism liberal in the procedural sense. So I think those two arguments are completely aligned. But that's a fairly serious argument, and I never tried that one out on the blog, and this gets to the heart of your question. Instead, all through 2004, 2005, these news stories would come up, many of them in Inside Higher Ed, about the controversy over the number of conservatives in academia. And I remember at one point in late 2004 responding facetiously to them by way of saying, it's a hard thing to try to keep the conservatives out of my department. I have to, you know, hold job applicants' letters up to the light to find the secret code words that will, you know, identify them as Bush voters, so that I can throw them into the round file. And of course the joke was that we have almost no conservative applicants in English or in literature generally. But I remember Ralph Luker over at the History News Network taking exception to this, you know, rather blithe dismissal, I think those were his words, of the problem. And I was sort of chomping at the bit at the time, saying, you know, I have a more substantial argument to make, and it'll be in the first 3-4 chapters of What's Liberal About the Liberal Arts. But I don't want to show my hand ahead of time on the blog. In fact, you know, sometimes I use the blog just for, you know, silly humor and facetiousness and mockery and things like that. And on the one hand, I want to give people the idea that the book will be a little more substantial than they may be expecting. And on the other hand, I don't want to give away some of my more substantial arguments ahead of time. So I'll give you the Kuhn footnote, but I'm not going to make the more serious case about conservatives in the job pipeline until we go to print. In the meantime, if some people thought that my responses to conservative complaints on the blog were a bit too snarky, I think that is usually the word bandied about, so be it. I figured, you know, the blog is one kind of medium for a kind of more casual and shall we say, interactive kind of banter, and the book is going to be, one hopes that the book will still be read 10 years from now in a way that, you know, a blog entry may not be. Now, then that provokes the question, well, what are blog entries doing in rhetorical occasions? And the answer is, well, we'll see. The thing that, I mentioned this in the preface to that section of rhetorical occasions, I didn't think of that section so much as an attempt to legitimate blog entries as an experiment, because here are blog entries stripped of comments and stripped of hyperlinks. What do they look like when they're no longer part of that, you know, literally that web, those internets and their tubes? What do they look like when they're published as standalone essays, you know, without the hyperlinks and without the commentary? And on that, we'll just have to see. I mean, the risk, of course, was that they're going to look denatured, that they're going to be fish out of water, and we know what happens to fish left out of water too long. But I'm willing to give it a shot and try to find out. And what we did, Sean Hunter at UNC Press, and I think Sean actually picked most of those entries. We tried to pick things that were a cross-section, some things which were entirely silly, like my Republican National Convention coverage, or my suggestion that the only way for Democrats to win nationally was to resell the Louisiana Purchase back to the French, alongside two or three entries that were my 3,000-4,000 word blog entries on the history of literary theory. Now, the objection I can imagine to that is that, okay, well, you pick these blog entries, but you pick the ones that were already the most academic. I don't think that's necessarily true, because, like I say, there are a few things in there that are bloggier than others. And whether or not that little experiment works, we will have to see. I mean, I have to confess that when I see blog entries taken out of the blog and put on the page, I do feel like something has been lost in translation, and we have yet to see whether something is gained.